and abundant, sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in Jasper.
Donald Jeffries Show.
And welcome to the Donald Jeffries Show. This is Donald Jeffries. My guest for the first hour is Joseph McBride, and boy, what an impressive resume he has. He has the connections, and I'm very envious of this. As you know, I talk a lot about Jobiz, and I have a new book on Jobiz out myself, so I'm very interested in that industry. He's the author of 23 books, including acclaimed biographies of Frank Capra, Steven Spielberg, John Ford. I think he's got one about Ernst Lubitsch, and he has a new one about Billy Wilder, which we're going to be particularly today because he obviously has an interest in promoting that. It's just out. He also, from my standpoint, the reason I knew of him originally is because, much like John Barber, he comes from the world of entertainment, but he crosses over into my territory, the JFK assassination. He wrote probably the one of the few, maybe the only book that really focused on the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. The JFK assassination, Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer E.D. Tippit. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Hey, Don. Really great to be on your show. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. There was a monograph on Tippit by Gary Muir in 1971 that's unpublished, but it's floating around the internet that's good. And then Dale Myers did a book on Tippit that I called The Warren Report, the Tippit Case. And my book
Malice,
is it's an under-researched aspect of the case. That's why I spent 31 years focused on that, and as well as JFK's murder, but they're intertwined. And I was following the advice of the great Kennedy researcher Penn Jones Jr., who I revere, and he was kind of a mentor of mine, and he said, take one aspect of the case, something that hasn't been covered properly, and research the hell out of it, which is what I did.
Yeah, that's great. You did kind of, or my guest last week was Vince Palomera, who obviously took that to heart and is specifically on the Secret Service.
He is such a great researcher. His work on the Secret Service is amazing and so revealing, isn't it? Yeah.
Incredible, it sure is. Well, because I definitely want to get into that and talk a lot about JFK, but I want to, first of all, just your fascinating background, because I didn't mention that you, this is my first, I didn't even know you had any connection to Hollywood at first, but then I'm looking, you know, I have a series of, they come from way back when, they're a series of Hollywood books that were pyramid books published, and they're very thin, pyramid illustrated.
Oh, yeah, I had two of those, yeah.
Yeah. So I've got your, and I have Joan Mellon, who's been a guest on the show too. She wrote those too.
Yeah, so. Yeah. She and I are. I don't know. I've met probably some others. You mentioned John Barber, but Joan Mellon was a distinguished film critic and still is, and she writes now about the JFK case. And so I kind of go back and forth between the two myself. I've spent a lot of time writing film history. But I've been a journalist since 1960, and I've written about many, many other things besides film. And I've done my first book was on baseball. Oddly enough, when I was a kid, I was a baseball fanatic, and I wanted to read a book on baseball slang, and I couldn't find one, so I thought I'll write one. That's usually why I write a book, is that I want to read a book on the subject, and nobody's done it, you know, or they haven't done it right.
That's fantastic. And when I first heard about you, I think you posted on Facebook, and I remember that you were one of the writers of the cult classic film Rock and Roll High School.
That's right. That's I get a lot of requests. That movie just lasts, and it's a cult classic. And I do podcasts on that frequently, and everybody seems to love that film. And it's wonderful how that all worked out. It was the product of many people who all pooled our talents and made something lasting. It only cost $280,000, which today would not even pay for catering on a film, but it was a terrific film. Alan Arkush did a fabulous job directing it, and but the thing that made it a wonderful movie is The Ramones. They got the Ramones to be in it. It's the only narrative film that they're in. There's some documentaries in them, but they play themselves, and they're just hilarious in the film, and their music is fabulous, too.
I'm hoping to get one of the widows of the Ramones on the show. Our mutual friend Bob Wilson, who hooks me up with so many people. He has amazing.
Right.
So many connections. It's incredible. But he has a connection to one of the Ramones widows. I can't.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it? That'd be terrific. Yeah, it's so sad that they've been dying off young. But Joey Ramone died at age 49, I believe, and he was such a talented guy, and but anyway, they live on film.
It's fantastic. And so I want to start with how you made your way out to get, because one of the most fascinating things is that you worked with Orson Welles. So you're a young guy, you read a book about baseball, I guess that's your, and you're a journalist. And so how did you make your way? I assume you lived in California, so did you make some contacts?
I was living in Wisconsin, my home state. I'm from Milwaukee, and then I went to school in Madison at the University of Wisconsin. And while I was there, I wanted to be a journalist, and I was going to be an author of novels, and then I saw Citizen Kane in a film class in 1966, and it changed my whole life, because I thought, I'll make films and write about films. And I went and looked for a book on Welles, and I couldn't find one. There were very few books published on him at the time, and the only one in English I could find wasn't very good, so I decided to write one. I was going to write a book on Kane. I spent 2 years just writing about Kane, and I got a copy of a print. Back then, it was hard to see films, unlike today. You had to rent them, and I ran a campus film society so I could rent films and get the films I wanted to show. Like I had a double bill of Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole, which is one of the darkest American films. It's a great expose of media corruption and lying, with John Ford's Wagon Master, which is one of the most optimistic films, great film. I like to do perverse things like that. But I saw Kane 60 times while writing this book, and there was a copy of the script at the State Historical Society, which is on the campus, and it was in a collection of Welles's attorney. And so I didn't have any money to copy it, so I was working as a dishwasher, and I just went every day with my typewriter and typed an exact copy of the script and taught myself how to write screenplays with that. And so after a couple of years, I was seeing Welles's other films, and I realized, I should write a book about his whole career and not just that one film. So I did a book called Orson Welles, which was published by the British Film Institute in 1972, and I revised that in 1996. But in 1970, I virtually finished my manuscript, and I was already working on another book on John Ford, who's my favorite director, with my friend Michael Wilmington, and I wanted to interview Ford, and I wangled an interview with him. I wrote him a letter, and he didn't respond, so I called his office, and I got him on the phone. He was very cordial and said, come on out. So I went out there, and that's my first trip to Hollywood. And in that week, I met my three favorite directors, John Ford, Jean Renoir, and Orson Welles. And by the end of the week, I was acting in an Orson Welles film. Welles put me in The Other Side of the Wind, which was a project that he was about to start shooting, and I was in the first day of shooting until the end of shooting in 1976. It took till 2018 to come out. It's a long story. I was a consultant on the final release. It's on Netflix.
As a young guy, you hit off with Welles, and it seems like, because you kind of became part of his circle, right?
Well, I'd been writing parts of my book. I did a clever thing. I was selling parts of the book to magazines like Sight and Sound and Film Quarterly, etc., Film Heritage, and so I was getting published in them. I thought I would establish myself as a Welles expert that way, and it worked. And then when I had the book finished, the editor at the British Film Institute said, well, I'll almost accept it now based on your articles, but send it along, and a week later she accepted it, which was a very good way. And I recommend that to people if you're going to write a first book. But Wells, I had been sending these articles to him in magazines, care of his attorney, because they didn't have any other way to do it. And I had no idea where he was. He was always sort of somewhere in Europe. You'd read little notices in Variety that he was in Yugoslavia making a film or something. And I had no idea that he would be in Hollywood of all places. And so I called Peter Bogdanovich, who I emulated at the time because he was a young director. He had made this wonderful film, Targets, which is about...
Rock Hudson, right?
Yeah, it's about a mass murderer. It's a very prescient film, 1968, about a guy who takes a rifle and shoots people from a oil tower in Los Angeles on a freeway, and it's about this phenomenon that we see now all the time. And I thought this guy has a lot of talent, and he was interviewing directors a lot, like I was trying to do, and I was already doing some of that. So I got Peter's phone number, and I called him, and he said, "I'm on the other line with Orson. Could you hold on?" And I thought, "Oh my God!" And he came back, and he said, "Orson would like to talk to you. Call him at this number." You know, he gave me a number tomorrow at 5:30, and this kind of blew my mind that, you know, I was connected to Wells. So I called Wells, and the first thing he said was, "We're about to start shooting a film. Would you like to be in it?" And I thought he was, I couldn't believe it, almost. I'd never really acted, except being an altar boy, which is kind of a form of acting in a weird way. And all I could think of saying was something stupid. I said, "Is this going to be a feature-length film?" You know, because I couldn't imagine it'd be more than a short or something. And he laughed and he said, "We certainly hope so." And actually, that turned out to be a kind of a good question, because it took 48 years to become a feature-length film, but it did. So anyway, that 3 or 4 days later, I went to his house and spent several hours talking to him, you know, at great length about everything I wanted to ask him. And he told me all about this film that he was about to make, and he wanted to. Oh, and when I walked in, he had a book of mine on his mantelpiece called Persistence of Vision, which I'd published in Madison. It was a collection with my friends at the Wisconsin Film Society.
Orson Welles had your book?
Yeah, I had sent him the book.
Oh, you sent
because
it,
okay. it had my chapters on Citizen Kane and the Magnificent Ambersons and a short piece on Chimes of Midnight, his most recent great film, and or one of his, actually, he did one after that before I met him. But he had it on the mantelpiece. He said, "Finally, I meet my favorite critic." And I said, "Well, why do you say that?" And he said, "Because you're the only one who understands what I'm trying to do," which I thought was really a great compliment. And so we had a great talk, and talked about politics and filmmaking and all kinds of stuff. And I asked him things. You know, his career was sort of mysterious at the time, but he filled me in. And then we had dinner that night, and the next day I was acting for him in this film with Peter. We played a pair of squabbling film critics. He was kind of making fun of our personas as film critics, and we were going along with the gag and kind of exaggerating our quirky film nerdiness. And he let us kind of make up our own dialogue that day. And all through the shoot, he kept calling me back for more shooting intermittently, and he would let me work on the dialogue with him, excuse me, before the scene. We'd spend like an hour before every scene, and he'd say, "What would you say to John Huston, plays the lead role, he's a great old film director trying to make a comeback in Hollywood, and I play a guy who's writing a book about him," and asking him sort of pretentious, silly film buff questions, and Wells thought that was really funny. So I would come up with lines, and then he would reject some and accept some, and then he would reshape them and rewrite them and type them out. And once he had them typed out, I had to do them exactly as he wrote them. I couldn't improvise words, or he even wouldn't let me improvise movements. He told me exactly how to move, and I was actually grateful. Most actors wouldn't like that, but I was not an actor, and I was grateful that he told me how to do it. But once I tried to improvise something, and he got mad at me, you know. But I thought he was the greatest actor's director in the history of the cinema, so I was really relieved that he was telling me how to do it. But he was kind of roughing me. He was kind of bullying for 3 years. Although I played a tape of the first day's shooting, which I made a tape while we were shooting a scene, and he was actually quite complimentary. But I forgot that because he was giving me a hard time a lot. And after 3 years, one of the crew said at Rush's, Wells had complimented my acting. And I suddenly relaxed, and I felt really good. I didn't realize he really liked what I was doing. So for the next 3 years, I had a good time. But it was a fabulous experience because he had this great cast of all kinds of fabulous people on Edmund O'Brien, Paul Stewart, Susan Strasberg. It went on and on. Norman Foster, fascinating people. Mercedes McCambridge from throughout the history of film. And Houston showed up 3 years into the shooting. Wells told me the first day, I said, who's going to play the lead? And he said, it's either John Huston or Peter O'Toole doing his imitation of John Huston. And so we had to just sort of talk to Wells as if he were Huston or whoever. And 3 years into the shooting, I went to Arizona for some concentrated shooting we did, and Huston had finally been cast. And so I asked where he was, and they said he's in that room over there. And I opened the door, and he was pulling on his pants with his old spindly legs, and I was embarrassed. He was changing his costume. And he came out. I apologize. He came out, and I said, Mr. Huston, I'm really glad to meet you. And he said, oh, nice to meet you, Joe. And I said, I've been waiting for you for 3 years to be in this film. And Huston looked really kind of shocked. He said, you've been in this picture for 3 years? And I think that was the moment when he realized what he was getting into, what a kind of a nightmare it would be.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Orson Welles. He, and again, I just got done, you know, my book was just published on Borrowed Fame, Money, Mysteries, and Corruption in the Entertainment World. So I go over a lot of this stuff and it's kind of the background of Hollywood. But Welles' career was really unique because here's the guy, the boy wonder. He's, you know, Citizen Kane comes out, I think, when he was 25, incredibly young. And this is considered, you know, the greatest movie ever, technically at least. So many, so many you know, innovations came from that. But from there, A Magnificent Ambersons obviously has come to be appreciated. But his last several years were kind of like that, where he had these projects that took forever. And, of course, you know, one of the favorites I want to talk about is he wanted to do a movie on the RFK assassination starring the ill-fated Sal Mineo. And that never came to be. And then, of course, he ends his days up you know, narrating that one of those awful documentaries about the predictions of Nostradamus, where he basically had to do things to make money because his films never made any money, from what I understand. So it's really kind of a strange career arc where he kind of started at the top and slowly went down, didn't he? Or am I mistaken?
Well, I take issue with that. That's the standard view of his life and career. But what people didn't know, for one thing, was that he was shooting films every day for the last 15 years of his life. When he came back to America in 1970, he was blacklisted during the late 40s and went to Europe for a long time and came back and basically lived in L.A. till the end of his life. And that's the period when I knew him. And I wrote a book called Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career, which came out in 2006. And that was a hard book to write because it was very complex. What I was trying to do was counter that myth that he was in a decline, because I think he made a lot of great films after those two great films you mentioned. Touch of Evil is a masterpiece, and Chimes of Midnight, I think, is his best film, and most people in America haven't even seen that. For a long time, you couldn't see it, and it's out on Criterion. I did a 30-minute interview on the Blu-ray. It's a Shakespeare adaptation of the Henry IV and V plays. It's a magnificent film. And he was working all the time and always made good films. He had trouble finishing films. He had great trouble getting money to make films. But those things you mentioned, that he did a lot of schlocky acting, and he would narrate almost anything, commercials or voiceovers, whatever. But he used that money to make films, and that's what people kind of didn't realize, because they weren't seeing these films. They had trouble getting distribution or trouble getting finished. And Other Side of the Wind was his big project of the later years. He poured so much into it, including a lot of his own money. So he was making a lot of money from these films, but he was using it to make films. And Jonathan Rosenbaum, another Welles critic, says that's the true scandal of Welles' career, because in Hollywood you're not supposed to use your own money to make films, and people resented that. And so they'd make fun of him doing wine commercials or whatever. But, you know, that's just the way he supported himself. But he made a tremendous number of interesting projects, and they're kind of still slowly coming out because people are putting them together, and some are still fragmentary, but some of the fragments are really good. I mean, he did a 40-minute version of The Merchant of Venice, which is superb, and he did parts of The Dreamers, which was an Isaac Dinesen story, and he only finished 27 minutes of it, but it was put together by the Munich Film Museum, and it's really beautiful. It holds together as a short film. But he also did F for Fake in his later years. It's a great film, and quite a lot of projects. And so I wrote this book to, first of all, just cover them as a reporter or a historian. You know, I saw all these things, and I was telling people what he did. And I was making the argument that he was a very successful independent filmmaker before that term was even invented. He wasn't the first person to make independent films outside the system, but he was one of the few. And that made him anathema in the eyes of the media in America, who were very vicious toward him. In Europe, they were not. Like when he died, Le Monde did 20 pages on him the next day, and in America, the obituaries said he was a failure and a has-been. And the New York Times actually did in their obituary, they said he'd been inactive as a director for the last several years, and they actually had to run a correction because it was just false. So I've updated that book. It's coming out in January from University Press of Kentucky. It's the first time it's going to be out in paperback. And I added a chapter on the completed Other Side of the Wind, evaluated, and I wrote about his early film, Too Much Johnson, was rediscovered. That's another thing. Films have been rediscovered. This was a film he made in 1938 that was never shown publicly. It was supposed to be parts of a theatrical production, and he couldn't finish it for a variety of reasons. He shot a lot of film, and it's really wonderful. It's a black and white silent tribute to silent films, and you can see it online. And it was found miraculously in a warehouse in Italy through a series of strange coincidences, and restored by the Eastman House and other archives. And it's really superb, and Joseph Cotten is in it, and his Mercury Theater Company. And you can see it online, and it's a feature-length film, even though, you know, it wasn't intended to be a standalone film, but it was made 3 years before Citizen Kane. So I write about that as well. So it kind of bookends his career. Those two kind of lost projects have been brought back to life. And so he had a very active and very
I guess I should have reframed to say that, you know, he just basically maybe he had trouble, you know, getting these things completed, getting the financing, getting made, because he was blacklisted for a while. But before we leave Orson Welles, I want to have time to talk about other stuff. I want to go into the what I think my audience would be most interested in, this RFK assassination film project he had.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
So talk about that.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of screenplays, too, that he couldn't get money for, you know, because he would try to sell them. And I mean, there's a lot of frustration involved, but I read all of his, or almost all of his unproduced screenplays, and several of them are really superb. One of them is called either Assassin or The Safe House, and it's about Sirhan Sirhan. And I recently, you know, I was one of the people who wrote a letter to the parole board in California asking that Sirhan be paroled because he didn't shoot Robert Kennedy. He shot other people, but somebody else shot Robert Kennedy, probably the security guard behind him, Thane Caesar, who died recently. But that case was a big cover-up job. And Sirhan has been in prison for, oh, God, how many years is it? 50-plus years now. And he's in there for political reasons. He's basically a political prisoner. If he had shot several people, and a U.S. senator running for president wasn't involved, he would have been out long ago. And he's not a threat to society. But anyway, so Welles wrote this excellent screenplay with Donald Freed, who you'll remember. He's he's written a lot of interesting assassination-related and political tales, and he was involved in the film Executive Action, for example. And Freed wrote a script, and Wells rewrote it, and it's a very intense, intimate story of this young man, Sirhan, who's turned into a patsy and brainwashed by a CIA mind control expert. And there was such a man, and Wells would have played that part. And it's in this safe house where this guy is brainwashing him and training him to do this mission and hypnotizing him. And Oya Kodar, who as well as his companion, worked with him on a lot of projects, would have been a spy who was mixed up with this case. But it was there's also a Secret Service agent who finds out there's a plot against Robert Kennedy, a black Secret Service agent who gets involved trying to save Robert Kennedy. And it's a terrific script, really a fine script, and it should be filmed. And as you say, he wanted Sal Mineo to play the part, and Mineo was willing to do it. And he got murdered, oddly. You know, they claimed it was a random robbery thing in his garage of his apartment house in West L.A. And but he would have been terrific as Sirhan. And that wasn't what killed the project. It was just too political and too controversial for anybody to do it. And it's a shame it wasn't filmed, but it could still be filmed. It, you know, it doesn't actually require any changes. It's a terrific screenplay.
I see somebody do that now. Well, so let's, and I want to make sure you get, because you want to talk about your new book, which is about another director, Billy Wilder, who I guess I know mostly from Some Like It Hot.
Yeah.
Favorite film,
probably
by
the funniest American sound film, I would say.
Incredible, and I love the way he threw Joey Brown. I love the early talkies. I love the pre-code talkies. And Joey Brown was a star at the beginning of the sound era, and he just kind of threw him in as the memorable part where he was the editor.
Yeah, what a great part is it?
Yeah, that great. What's the great line where he's basically saying, "Well, it doesn't matter that much if you're not really a woman."
Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis are masquerading as women in the roaring 20s to escape mobsters, and this crazy millionaire kind of falls in love with Jack Lemmon, and Lemmon goes along with it. He kind of discovers his inner female while he's in this disguise. It's quite a funny and interesting performance. And today it seems ahead of its time because it's sort of about gender fluidity, and it kind of questions the whole notion of rigid notion of gender identity. And audiences just love it. And at the end of the film, though, he reveals to this guy as they're escaping, Joey Brown, this old millionaire, he reveals in wonderfully written dialogue by Wilder and his partner I.L. Diamond a series of reasons why he can't get married. He says, "I smoke like a fish, and I lived with a saxophone player, and I can't fit into your mother's wedding dress." And Joey Brown keeps saying, doesn't matter, you know, things like that. And finally he says, "Oh," you know, he pulls off his wig and says, "I'm a man." And Joey Brown has a big smile because he had a huge mouth, you know. And he said, "Oh, well, nobody's perfect." And that's the end of the film. That's a great ending line, one of the classic ending lines. Oh, and the audience just roars with laughter, you know.
Marilyn Monroe almost at her peak, I guess, in that, just, you know, really sexy and just the epitome of a movie star.
Yeah, Monroe was at her best in that film. I mean, I've never seen her give a more poignant, realistic performance. Howard Hawks, who I did a book on called Hawks on Hawks, directed her twice. Wilder and Hawks were the only two directors who did two films with her, and she was difficult to direct. She had a lot of.
Well, I got to ask you. I think it was on one of the HBO or one of them where they had a like a short film on. Did Marilyn Monroe really take like 50 some takes to say like two or three words, like "Come in, darling," or "Come in, baby"?
Yeah, that was a notorious incident. She had a lot of problems psychologically, and she was also drinking on the set. She had a bottle, I think it was a water bottle where she had liquor in it, and she would guzzle booze, and she was kind of in a fog, and she was on a lot of barbiturates and drugs, sleeping pills and things. She had trouble sleeping, and one reason she came in late a lot, and one reason was she had trouble sleeping, and so she would roll into the set, you know, like at 11 a.m. or, it's somewhat exaggerated. I found out they had an accountant do a list of how many hours she had wasted being late or whatever, and it didn't add up to as much as people liked to claim. But she had 13 sick days, and she even tried to kill herself during the shoot. It was a sad story, but she drove Wilder crazy. And in one scene, there were something like 85 takes where she's supposed to come in distraught after Tony Curtis has jilted her, and she's rummaging through a chest of drawers, and she's trying to find a bottle of booze, and she's supposed to say, "Where's that bourbon?" And she had great trouble saying that simple line, and Wilder kept trying. Jack Lemmon said it was the most virtuosic display of directing he had ever seen. Wilder tried, you know, 80 different ways of telling her how to do the scene, and she couldn't do it. She'd fumble the line or get the business wrong, and then he would write the line, you know, inside the drawer, and she still couldn't do it. Anyway, they finally got the shot, although when you see the film, her back is to the camera, and the I wonder if they dubbed it in later. That's what I would have done anyway at that point. But as he said, he had a wonderful line. He said that I have an Aunt Ida in Vienna who would show up every morning at 8 o'clock and she'd know her lines perfectly, but who'd pay to see her in a film? You know. So Marilyn Monroe was worth all the trouble. She was, I was going to say about Hawks told me that he said she was completely unreal on the screen. She was wonderful, but he thought she was not like a real person. And he did Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and Monkey Business with her, and she's delightful, but she's kind of like a fantasy figure, as she is in Wilder's film Some Like It Hot. But in Some Like It Hot, she's very real. She plays a troubled singer in a band, and she's a vulnerable, sweet person who's got this obsession with marrying a millionaire, which is her kind of flaw. But she's exploited sexually by Tony Curtis's character, and you really feel for her. And the fact that it's in black and white, and Wilder handles her very sensitively, and the part is beautifully written by Wilder and Diamond. So she comes off, you know, it's a very fine, dramatic, comic performance.
Absolutely. Well, there's a couple questions from you in the chat room before I think it's too far. Is there anywhere we could access the Wells scripts, and was Wells going to play Jolly, Dr. Jolly West?
Yeah. Well, there is no published version of the script. I have copies of his scripts, but it hasn't been published. There was a long article written about it by another writer on there's a very good Wells fan scholarly site called wellsnet.com that Ray Kelly runs, and somebody else wrote a very long piece on it. It's worth reading, and I handle it in a 3 or 4 paragraphs in my book, because I cover so much in my book. I'm trying to sort of study his whole career. I found that to understand his later work, you had to go back to the very beginnings of his career to see why he became an independent filmmaker. And I followed the thesis that a friend of mine, Douglas Gomery, had come up with, that Wells was always an independent filmmaker, even from the beginning. But he had the resources of a major studio briefly, for a brief time, and did very avant-garde things. He was basically an avant-garde filmmaker working in a commercial medium, which is kind of a contradiction. Jean Renoir said Wells was an aristocrat working in a popular medium, and that's the source of the problem. And he occasionally then worked for studios, but most of the time he was independent, but he went totally independent. But going back to the Sirhan script, yes, Wells would have played, Jolly West was a different figure who was involved in the CIA MK Ultra program, but Wells would have played a character based on another man who was involved with Sirhan, who was a CIA mind control specialist. But it was a slightly fictionalized version of that. But the fellow he would have played was this large, heavy-set, strange guy, and Wells would have been perfect casting for that. And he was also very, you know, intelligent. It's kind of a Dostoevskian discussion that they're having about killing. You know, Wells has lines in there like this guy is saying, assassination is a humane thing to do because it's better than going to war with a country and killing hundreds of thousands of people. You just kill one man, and, you know, that's a specious argument. But Frank Capra once told me, he said, always give your villains their best arguments, you know. And so this man is an intelligent but sinister figure. It's a fascinating discussion and script. But it'd be a relatively low budget to film because it all takes place in this kind of empty house almost with a two-way mirror and things like that. And, you know, it's not a terribly elaborate production, but it's an excellent film. Like a lot of his scripts that were not produced would have been good films, you know.
When you knew Wells and Bogdanovich and all these people, I don't know when you – I mean, I started – being interested in the JFK assassination as a teenager in the mid-1970s when I worked for Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry in my area. So, you know, he was my idol, my hero, and, you know, this was heady stuff. But so I always had an interest in that from the time I, you know, before I was a young adult. Even
yeah.
When did you come to be interested in the JFK assassination? And I'm assuming if Wells was going to make a movie about the art, that he probably had an interest in the assassinations himself. Did these topics ever come up with him, or were you not interested in them?
We didn't really talk about that per se. We talked about other political things. I think there was a young man, Howard Grossman, and his girlfriend, Agape Stassinopoulos, who's actually the sister of Arianna Huffington. And they worked on the film, and they were involved in the RFK movement. There were just a few people I knew in L.A. who were trying to research the RFK case.
Well, that Arianna Huffington, she won't even she wouldn't even allow Jesse Ventura to be on her network because she didn't want any.
No, she's very conservative, but her sister was not, you know. But anyway, they were trying to get Wells to do an RFK film. I don't know if this was the same project or not, but I do remember at the time there was talk about that they were trying to produce a film about it. But I don't know how much Wells was interested in the JFK assassination. Wells and I had an argument the first day we met because I was criticizing Lyndon Johnson, I was an anti-war activist in Madison, and you know, I thought that, well, Wells was arguing that Johnson was a great president because of his domestic policies, which, you know, were, a lot of them were very good, like, you know, Medicare and voting rights and civil rights legislation meant a lot to Wells. He was an old New Deal liberal, and those were obviously important things. But I said, you know, I was trying to argue, and it was true, that the war destroyed a lot of Johnson's program, unfortunately. That was the tragedy, one of the tragedies of Johnson's administration. Wells got really angry at me, and I also was criticizing some of the anti-war people because I was covering them in Madison as a reporter, and I said, they're getting crazy. They're going to kill somebody very soon in Madison. And he got really upset because he couldn't brook any criticism of anti-war people. They all had to be perfect in his mind. And 2 days later, when I went back to Madison, I got off the plane, got into a cab, and I said to the cab driver, so what's happened in the last couple of days? And he said, oh, the students just blew up a building. That morning, they had blown up the Army Math Research Center and killed a graduate student. This was a protest against the war, and that helped end the anti-war movement, like the Greenwich Village bombing. So it was very foolish and self-destructive, and they were probably egged on by an agent provocateur who was still at large named Leo Burt. And so I was right. I predicted this, but I was on the ground covering this, and I knew what I was talking about. And, you know, Wells mentions this. It's mentioned in his film Hopper Wells, which came out recently, which is, he did a documentary on Dennis Hopper. He did a long discussion with Hopper during the making of Other Side of the Wind, and part of it was going to be in, part is in The Other Side of the Wind, but he was thinking of doing, you know, a whole documentary on Hopper, and so they put it together. And that bombing is mentioned, so Wells knew about it. But your question was, oh, when did I get interested? I got interested because I was a Kennedy volunteer in 1960 on his Wisconsin presidential primary campaign, and my mother was vice chairman of the state party. Shortly after that, she was part of the Kennedy campaign, and she got me involved as a volunteer, and I met him twice during that campaign. And my proudest moment was she set up a little rally called Kids for Kennedy near my house a couple blocks away at the Wauwatosa City Hall, and it was over lunch hour. It was just mothers and kids, and so we all got to hang out with Kennedy for a while, and he had no protection. He came with a couple of aides and a reporter, and that was about it. And but we stood around and talked to him, and at one point he asked a question about profiles and courage, and I had just read it, and I put my hand up and answered the question, and he said, only in Wisconsin. He said, I hope I don't have to run against you in 1964, which I thought was really the nicest thing anybody ever said to me. And I met him again at the big rally right before the vote, and it's in the film Primary, which is a classic documentary film. And so I was, he seemed very real to me. He was, you know, one of the first people I knew who died. And but I was worried about his lack of security. And at the big rally, he had no visible security. There was a policeman nearby, but not very close. And so I wrote a short story in October of 61 in high school as a freshman about his assassination called The Plot Against a Country. And that's probably the first, I put this in quotes, literary dealing with the assassination. To call it literary is kind of silly because it was so badly written. It was really amateurish, but at least I was worried about it, and I was imagining this terrible event, and I wrote about his autopsy and the investigation and things like that. And so when he was shot, I was in high school, and at the cafeteria line, I was just, I'd come from Mass, Marquette University High School, and the kid said, oh, did you hear Kennedy was shot? And I laughed because I thought it was a joke, and then I realized he wasn't kidding. So I spun around and ran two blocks to a drugstore where I knew there was a radio, and I listened to the radio from 12:40 onward, 10 minutes after the shooting, until 1:30 I had to get back to class. And what was interesting was for the first 20 minutes, they kept saying the shots came from the front. They were reporting they came either from the railroad bridge or the hill to the right front. And then at 1 o'clock, they started saying the shots came from the back from a building called the Texas School of Repository.
Television accounts never did that. That's really interesting. Where were you getting the feed from? Was it local or...
These were network radio broadcasts. You know, I don't know if the guy who was controlling the radio was flipping around different networks or not, but I have a tape of some of those early radio broadcasts, and that's, you know, you can hear that, what they're saying. And these were based on eyewitnesses telling reporters what they thought happened. And many of the eyewitnesses, as we know, said shots came from the front. And it is clear from all the evidence, ballistics and other evidence, that there were shots from the front. The retaining wall, concrete retaining wall, there was somebody in a policeman's uniform firing a shot, probably one of the fatal headshots. He was hit twice in the head. There were shots from behind, but they weren't fired by Lee Harvey Oswald. He didn't fire any shots that day.
But I want to give you a chance to talk, because the chat room is saying we need to get. They're interested in your book about Tippett. So you got interested in the subject, and then you decided, less than 10 years ago, whenever it was, to write Into the Nightmare. So you decided to focus on this, taking Ben Jones. So talk a little bit about Into the Nightmare.
Yeah. Well, I was interested in the assassination. The point I was making, the very first day, I didn't believe the official story, because by the end of the day, I wasn't believing it. Oswald was on TV saying he didn't shoot anybody, and I believed him, partly because I was aware, I was already a journalist, and I know that when they change a story without explanation, there's a rat somewhere. You know, it smelled like a rat, because they didn't. If they had explained it plausibly, I might have been more believing, but I wasn't. So anyway, but now we dissolve forward. I was kind of a casual student of the assassination until the 70s, and then in a Watergate and the Church Committee and all that made me more interested. And but it was 1981 that I started my research on Tippett, and I decided to focus on the Tippett murder for the reason I mentioned, because it was undercovered and very little was known about him. So it really took 31 years to do the research and writing on the book. Actually, it was 1982. That's right. It took 31 years. It came out in 2013. And so I interviewed everybody I could find about Tippett. I interviewed his father, who told me what Tippett was doing. He heard this from Tippett's widow, who wouldn't give me an interview, but Edgar Lee Tippett had never been interviewed except once by the FBI. And he said that Marie Tippett told him shortly after the killing that a policeman had come to her and said he and Tippett were assigned by the police to hunt down Oswald in Oak Cliff, where he lived. And they were supposed to hunt him down, and Tippett got shot. And this other guy said, I really feel bad because I got into a traffic accident, didn't make it there, but J.D. got there and he got killed. And that policeman, I found out later, was William Menzel, who was the cop who was assigned to that district. Tippett was not in his own district. And it's unclear whether they were assigned to arrest Tippett or Oswald or kill Oswald. And I suspect it was to kill him, because I think they were going to try to kill him subsequently in the theater, and that didn't succeed. There was an attempt to do that, and he managed to miraculously escape, and so they killed him in the police station. But Tippett, I believe, drove into a police ambush. He was killed by some of his own officers, and I go into that in great detail. So it took a long time to find out all this, but I interviewed Tippett's mistress, Johnny Maxie Witherspoon, who was having an affair with him, and his boss at a diner, who was a right winger, and you know, I did all kinds of research. I interviewed Henry Wade, the DA, and Jim Lavelle, the chief detective in the Tippett case, who indicated to me that Captain Will Fritz, who's in charge of the homicide investigation of the murders of Kennedy and Tippett, basically told them to work up a case on Oswald for killing Tippett, because they really didn't have a case on him for killing Kennedy. And I said to Lavelle, well, what did you have on him for killing Tippett? And he said, well, we had witnesses, but that's not really a good answer, because
Helen
the
Markham.
Witnesses. Yeah, Helen Markham was the main witness, and she was totally, nutcase. And a lot of the witnesses contradicted themselves. It was almost like they had two sets of witnesses, which somebody had proposed later, and I think they did, and I think Jack Ruby helped stage the scene, and he might have been there himself. A lot of the witnesses were connected with Jack Ruby, and some of them identified Oswald, but they did it under duress, or you know, in a police lineup where Oswald was the only guy disheveled and bloody, and all, you know, it was all kind of a big farcical investigation, and they basically dropped the investigation when Oswald was shot. And they didn't, the police, you know, you'd think with a fellow officer getting killed, they would try to really investigate it properly, but they didn't want to know. And they wanted Oswald to be the fall guy, and that's
what
basically
about
the story.
There's a question in the chat room, what about the phone call from the record store?
Oh, yeah, well, Tippett was running around doing strange things, too, and that's part of the story. He was, at 1 o'clock, he was killed about 1:08 or 1:09, and the Warren Commission lied and said it was 1:15, but he ran into a record store nearby, got out of his car and ran in and made a phone call and just stood there and either didn't connect or somebody just spoke to him. He didn't say anything, and then he ran out again, and there were witnesses about that. And then after that, he stopped a guy who was driving along the street and pulled him over and looked inside the guy's car, the back of the car, looking for Oswald, obviously. And the other policeman, Menzel, was involved in a traffic accident nearby. He was allegedly sent to the scene of the accident, but he cleared it in 4 minutes, which is impossible if you're going to really investigate an accident. So I think that was a cover for him having a fender bender, and he didn't make it in time, and Tippett dead and got killed. Tippett was doing strange, frantic things. He was running around frantically in Oak Cliff looking for Oswald. So that's the story. But it, you know, it took a long, long time to get that story. It's a cold case, and parts of it are not clear. And I tried to investigate who might have killed him, and I came up with a number of suspects. And one thing I'm glad about, and when you write a book on anybody, you hope that other people will follow your lead. And other people have gotten interested in Tippett again, and they've come up with further possible suspects and further nuances and things. So I'm glad that people are doing that.
Well, we're running out of time. I want to make sure that there's another question. Did you go into the? And I apologize. I have not read your book yet, which you're kind enough to send me. Did you ever look into the Oswald multiple wallets that were found at the scene?
Yeah, that's part of the story, that there were, you know, several wallets. How many people have five wallets? And there was a wallet left at the scene, obviously to incriminate him. You know, the police sometimes plant evidence at crime scenes to make people appear guilty, and that's part of what happened. But so, you know, I was researching this book while I was doing many other things in my life, including writing film books, which is my avocation, and now I'm teaching full-time at San Francisco State, and I've been writing books, and I have this Billy Wilder book called Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, which just came out. It's a long critical study. I spent about 12 years off and on doing that, but when I do books, I do other things at the same time. I'm working. I did a book on the Coen brothers. It's coming out in March, called The Whole Dern Human Comedy: Life According to the Coen Brothers. So I do multiple projects, but the Kennedy Project is my lifelong endeavor. It's the most important moment in my life, as it is to many people. So it changed my whole life, and I still research it, and I'm still working on it.
We only have a little over a minute until you said you had to leave at 52 so you can get to your class. So sum up how people can find you. Anything else you want to say in the minute or so that's left?
Oh, well, I hope they read the Billy Wilder book. I love Billy Wilder, who's a great satirist, political satirist and social satirist. And he was kind of my sex education teacher, I think, when I was a Catholic repressed kid. When I saw Some Like It Hot, it opened a whole world of new kinds of sexuality to me. And I was a big Marilyn Monroe fan. And then Irma La Douce, which was his biggest commercial hit. It was kind of comical because I kept trying to see that, and I kept walking out because I was so scandalized. And I finally made it all the way through, which was a big breakthrough for me. It helped break my inhibitions. Wilder was helping to defeat the prudery and censorship that was the norm in America in those days, and he was making us more sophisticated as he did throughout his life, because he was a European who came to America, like his mentor Ernst Lubitsch, who I wrote a book about, and they brought a more cosmopolitan European attitude of tolerance towards different kinds of sexuality. And but he also was a very acute critic of American life and venality. And I just did the audio commentary for The Apartment, which is one of his great films that attacks corporate bad behavior by men toward women. It sort of anticipates the Me Too movement. And Ace in the Hole is a great film about a newspaper man fabricating a... he keeps a man trapped in a cave to get a scoop so he can get a better job in New York, and it's a real indictment of the media. The media have covered up the assassination all these years, the mainstream media, and it's fallen to the independent press and the researchers to tell us the truth. And so I like people like Billy Wilder and Orson Welles, who are mavericks and challenge conventional wisdom and make films that are controversial, and sometimes they pay the price for it, as Welles did. Wilder was successful, unlike Welles, for a long time, but then after a while, Wilder fell out of fashion. He made great films in his later years, like Private Life of Sherlock Holmes and Avanti, but people didn't go to see them. He was actually more romantic than people realized. They thought he was a cynic, but I try to counter that whole idea and say he was a closet romantic, or his partner Diamond called him a disappointed romantic. And that's kind of what I explore in my book. And he has such a rich career. He was a journalist, too, for a long time. And that's one reason I got along with him, when I interviewed him a lot for my book. And I went on the set of his newspaper film, The Front Page. And old newspaper guys get along immediately. And that informed his work.
Well, Joe, I want to make sure you get you out of, because you've already, I want to make sure you get to your class in time. You're just a fascinating guy. What a career you've had, Joe. And I appreciate you coming by. We'll have to talk to you, because you can spend an hour talking to anyone.
Yeah. Well, anytime, Don. It's great to be with you, and thank you. And yeah, I do have to get to class. I have a John Ford class coming up, but it's been wonderful talking to you about all these subjects, and we sure covered a lot of ground in less than an hour, didn't we?
Thank you so much, Joe. We'll have to have you back on. We'll be right back into these words.
Okay, thanks, Don. Thank you.
calling?
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
In a time of fake news, fake politicians, and fake fiat currency, it's getting harder to find the genuine article. That's why when it comes to precious metals, I call the team I can trust. This is David Knight from my friends at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange. Proudly veteran-owned and operated, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange is your home for gold and silver coins, bullion, jewelry, and more. Prices and inventory are updated daily, so you get the most competitive possible pricing. And when it's time to sell your gold and silver items, they pay top dollar. Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange also accepts and deals in Bitcoin. Call or text the owner, Tony Arterburn, today at 888-667-1836. That's 888-667-1836. Or just go to wisewolf.gold. From bullion to Bitcoin, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Hi there, this is John Barber, and you're listening to The Most Informed Man in America, my friend, fellow author, and raconteur, the great Donald Jeffries Show.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Uncle, I'll bet you remember the time when Benjamin Fulford said that the Asian Secret Society was going to dispatch ninjas to take out the Illuminati to change the entire world for the better.
That ain't never gonna happen. That never did.
It never did, did it?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, because there's a lot of false promises.
It's fools? I can't say one.
We better not say and be polite. But there are no false promises at the Ocelli.com radio network.
That's exactly it. Not. It's truth, the point, right to the point. And this is what I like. Straight to the point.
Ocelli.
Ocelli.com.
Listen now.
Revelation through conversation.
This is Ron Paul. You're listening to The Donald Jeffries Show.
Ocelli.com.
Show.
Hope you guys enjoyed Joe McBride in the first hour. We're opening up the phone lines, these tricky phone lines, and hopefully they'll be working. Hopefully someone will want to call in. The number is 319-527-5016. That's 319-527-5016. Love getting your phone calls. Love your questions in the chat room. It's good to see familiar names like Chris in the chat room. Let's see. I'm sorry, Joe is such a fascinating combination of Hollywood, very much like John Barber, Hollywood and the JFK assassination. So just trying to even get the questions in were difficult. The early fake seizure in Dealey Plaza and the ambulance is straight. Yeah, absolutely. I remember Ben Jones had articles about that. I believe they ended up, identifying a young guy, I think it was, did it, but you're right, he was never admitted to Parkland. A lot of people have speculated that it was a distraction. What the conspirators are doing. And I'm in Hidden History 3, I'm writing, found some interesting testimony. Looking at some of the Orleans Parish grand jury testimony back during Garrison's case, and also some of the HSCA testimony, which is maddening how that stuff is not, so much of it is unavailable. I don't know where it's at, but some of it you can find. And I don't remember which one it was, but I found a couple witnesses I'd never seen before who talked to basically verified Julianne Mercer's story about Joe's pawn shop and the truck and the identifying Jack Ruby. And one witness claimed that the truck had Joe's pawn shop and Jack Ruby's name on it. Really interesting. And he's completely unknown. I've never heard of her before. And all that will be in Hidden History Theory. If something was going on there. So certainly the fake epileptic seizure probably fits into that. Let's see what we have. In Hollywood, everyone's a producer or a hitman. Yeah, that's true. Porky. I used to love it when Bo would call Larry Porcupine. It took me a while to have a more appreciation. I'm a Curly guy. I love Curly. But Larry has his moments. Larry was pretty good. Hey, leave him all out, fellas. He just was great. Headed out Porcupine. Chris says someone falls to the death from the apartment of actor James Gunn. I had not heard that. I know about the young lover of Paul Lynn that fell off a balcony, and I addressed that in Armed Bar and Fame because I found in Hollywood, just like in the worlds of politics, or you don't know anybody in real walks of life that accidentally falls off a building. Hollywood, a place like it was a producer a couple, was it 2 years ago? I'm sure Chris knows the guy's name. What was the guy's name? But he had connections to Epstein and Bill Clinton, too. But he was a Hollywood producer. He was, I think, the longtime boyfriend of, what's that? Dang, she's still a good looking woman. She's in her 50s, but she knows it, too. She had, I can't believe I can't, an actress. But anyway, he fell or jumped off of a building a couple years ago. Very, very strange. Very strange death, which is off the course of a reappearing guy in the back of the pickup truck in Dealey Plaza films. Yeah, I mean, there's just so much of that out there, isn't there? And so it was fascinating talking to somebody like Joe, who's from that inside world. And again, there's a lot of crossover there. So, and I'm really interested in Orson Welles's RFK film. He was, was going to, make, and it never happened. And Tony Scott, no, not Tony Scott, Chris. That's somebody else. That was, I think he actually is known to have committed suicide at a very, I think it was like 68 or pretty old guy to be, deciding to jump off a bridge. Might have been older than that. I can't think of it. But at any rate, Steve Bing, that's it. Yes, thank you, Steve Bing. Yes, Steve Bing. And who was his girl? Who was his girlfriend? I don't like her at all. She consorted with a mobster, and she made a comment about if I was as fat as Marilyn Monroe, I'd kill myself. I'm fat as Marilyn Monroe, fat in all the right places. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. I can't believe I can't think of her name. Full of herself. British actress. I think she was with Hugh Grant. Elizabeth Hurley. Thank you, Chris. As I get older, I'm drawing blanks on it. I cannot stand that Elizabeth Hurley. Every day if you go to Yahoo, she – exactly. Yeah, Marilyn was never fat. No, if Marilyn Monroe was fat, I don't know what we're saying. Then I guess a lot of us love fat women. What sex appeal was all about. And certainly Some Like It Hot, the movie we were discussing, Billy Wilder's movie. Boy, that was that showed Marilyn to her best advantage. Very, very sexy. She was an Austin Powers. Yes, she was. And she made that nasty comment about Marilyn Monroe. She also was together for a long time with a mobster, Donnie Shax or something his name was. I don't know. But, you know, a real mobster, genuine mobster. And, you know, what is a gorgeous actress in Hollywood? I mean, I don't understand that. But, of course, that goes back to, you know, Johnny Roselli. People realize Johnny Roselli, you know, people think of him now as a guy that was connected in some way maybe to the conspirators of the JFK assassination and wound up in an oil drum right before he's supposed to testify for the HSCA, right? You know, he and Giancana both knocked off at the same time. But Roselli was a real ladies' man, and I remember it crushed me when I read that one of the women he dated in Hollywood was Donna Reed. Lovely, virginal Mary Bailey, Donna Reed. It just still bothers me to think that he might have, you know, had her. I'm sorry. It just really bothers me. But such is the allure of the mobsters, I guess, out there. Hollywood producer Clinton, friend Steve Bing's death roll, the suicide part of Epstein's Elite Express. Yeah, absolutely. He had Bing had all of the really did. And that was a Hollywood death. Did he fall? Did he jump? Was he or anything? But that's why I think there's a lot of overlap between the worlds of corrupt politics and the worlds of corrupt showbiz, because there's really a lot of you find these, and in our Unborrowed Fame, which I will I'll be promoting a lot now because it's officially been released now. It's been out for a few days, so please check it out. And as I say, I never ask anyone to buy my books. And I know this one is, you know, I don't know why it's priced at $42. It's almost 500 pages long. It's my thickest book so far, but has, you know, the index alone is so huge. And there's so many names in it, but it is what it is. And I understand the cost is prohibitive. So I just always suggest people, you know, ask your library to purchase it. I get a sale the same way. It gets in even more hands that way. A lot of times they'll purchase more than one copy. You know, you go to some of my other books, New York and Las Vegas and Chicago, big library systems, Baltimore. They would purchase, you know, 15, 20 copies of it for all their branches. So it's you know, like getting 15, 20 sales at one time. Plus, you know, all of those books will be read by who knows how many people that check them out. So just do that. I'd be grateful if you did that. Or if you have my books are in a lot of college libraries as well. So if you college alma mater, and you know, usually colleges listen to alumni. You know, you said I went to the college. Hey, check this guy's book out. They add it to your collection. They will typically. Fat girls need love too, but they got to pay. Said Glenn Quagmire. What's that scraping noise? I don't know. You hear a scraping noise? Don't know. Hopefully, I know there shouldn't be a scraping noise here. But if you've heard, speaking of fat girls, I bring it up. But there's a new thing, and I was really disturbed to hear it. That fraternities, and if you've read Bullyocracy, you know what I feel, how I feel about fraternities and sororities, the Greek life. I think again, it's just you know, the next step in bullying after. Call it something different and hazing, and there's been so many tragic deaths from that, which is just inexcusable that this stuff is still happening. But apparently they have this new, totally offensive thing. you never know what I'm going to talk about. I'm all over the place. But and I have a kind of a free-form thing here. But to me, this is sickening, and I don't know why. It's gotten a little bit of news, but you talk about fat shaming or body shaming. The fraternity, the newest thing is fraternity, something called hogging, where the fraternity members compete to try to get the fattest and most unattractive girl and have sex with her. Now, I don't know what's in it for the fraternity members doing that. I mean, to me, what did you win? I don't, maybe things have changed since I was young. And they're obviously doing it to humiliate the girls, but you're also, you get what, I don't, it makes no sense. But that is the latest craze. And if you study the psychology of the advanced bullies, which grew up to become politicians and celebrities in other fields, and they're really, most of them all have the psychopathic personalities of bullies. But if you remember, maybe 15 years ago, something like that, Al Gore was accused of raping a hotel maid. And again, I'm superficial. I don't want to criticize anyone's looks, but the maid was not remotely attractive in any way, shape, or form. She was older. And so everybody's kind of scoffed at it. But Gore had been accused of something inappropriate conduct like that with another maid as well. And apparently there's some psychology in these. If you look at Arnold Schwarzenegger, remember when he had the love child with the maid that, I've seen pictures when she was younger. And he was married to Maria Shriver, who was a good-looking woman. There's some kind of psychology these psychopaths have where they enjoy, like, doing, raping, women that are unattractive or overweight or something. I don't understand it, but I don't understand psychopathology. Let's see. Okay. Tony Scott's widow, Donna, has told police that the famed filmmaker, TV producer, did not have brain cancer informed. Okay. That's what the story was. That makes erroneous this morning's Good Morning America report that he had inoperable brain cancer, quoting a source. Interesting. Because I did mention Tony Scott's death briefly. I need to get more stuff from you. You've come up with some. Until I said Hoggy's at least 30 years old. I remember when I was in college. So then I go, wow. Well, I guess I didn't get around. I don't know. I mean, to me, that was something you didn't do if you were trying to be cool. And, I remember, the guys that there were chubby chasers, we used to call them. You never admitted to me. I don't understand. Like I said, I don't understand that. To me, it's a negative look for everybody involved. It's mean spirit, and it's really just, it's not other than, it's really, and I talked about that in Bullyocracy, where really sexual assault is really like the most extreme form of bullying imaginable. But that to me is an incredible amount of bullying, and you throw in sexual assault as well. But kind of like the family being the source for erroneous reports on JFK Jr. and WCB. Yeah, that's true. Porno-driven fantasy of nailing housekeeping, why they tell maids to us. Well, yeah, I understand that. But if you've seen these two maids, I don't know. I don't think they would have ever made it in any kind of porno. The assertion of spirit, that's it, exactly. I was a legit anti-skinny girl kid. Okay. Anti-skinny girl kid. Well, that's interesting. But you're right. I think that's what most people think. It's superiority. But again, I don't understand that kind of mindset, which is probably why I wrote about bullying, because I don't understand that trying to inflict your will on someone else. I don't get to me, women, the last thing I would want is to, I would be turned on. I would think most people that she wanted to do it with you. If she didn't want to, I just understand. And there's Jay checking in. Good to see you, Jay. Coroner's office, Craig Harvey, also tells Deadline that it's office in possession of part of a suicide note found in Scott Prius found at the scene. Harvey says multiple notes were found. The contents have not been made public. And were they ever made public, Chris? I don't know. That's great, because you have more in this chat room than I have on the brief mention in On Borrowed Fame. Rape is not about sex time. So I say, yeah, that's what we've been told. That's what we've told. I don't know, but the sexual organ is used, so I don't know. I don't buy a lot of stuff of what we're being told, but you're right, and I don't understand, because I don't understand the pathology. Oh, and there, here we go again. Jay comes up with that. I've seen that gif before. I think that's Jay's favorite thing. I remember one time at the chat room, you and a couple others were going back and forth, tried to distract me as much as you could with little pictures like that. But anyhow, so I watched last night. I watched Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s appearance on Tucker Carlson tonight, which is only on Fox Nation. And I basically you get like a couple months free of that. And I just did it to watch him, and there were a couple other people I wanted to see that he had on. So we got it just for that. And really, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the more I listen to this guy, and of course, if he just didn't have that hereditary voice problem, I mean, that it's such a shame that they can't do anything about that, because that holds him back. He's so brilliant. But just listening to him talk, this guy was, you know, ranting about the loss of the Bill of Rights. And he's exactly right that during over the last 2 years, every single amendment in the Bill of the Rights has been shattered. The only one that hasn't, ironically, is the Second Amendment. So for the Second Amendment people out there, that's the only one they haven't trampled on, really. Every other one is gone. And no one cares, because the civil libertarians aren't there. And Bobby Kennedy is a real hero, and I'm still trying as much as I can. I was on Dr. Cherry Tenpenny show again this past Monday. I don't have a link where it's to go up out there. I'll be sharing it when I do. But she's, you know, good friends with Bobby Kennedy, and I've asked her before. She said, "Oh, I can make that happen." So we'll see. I've had Del Bigtree on my other show, so, and that's his business partner. So we're like a Kevin Bacon, few degrees of separation. I know it can happen. He knows who I am. He has my books. I think he probably believes that I'm a little too extreme, because I write about all the Kennedy deaths, including his ex-wife, Mary Kennedy, who was found hanging in a barn right after she released his explosive excerpts from his journal to the New York Post, which included, you know, about how F.K. Jr. and Caroline and the rest of the family really hated Ed Schlossberg, and when he was feuding with his sister at the time. Says things like that, things about Andrew Cuomo. Let's see. "You got me. I'm an ass man," Jay says. Yeah, me too. Well, me too. That's an amazing one right there. 41-3. I don't know about 41-3/8, though. Chuck finds beauty in many shapes and sizes. That's right. Beauty's in the eye of the beholder. I was on Rents this past Monday. We're talking about I'm all over the place there. We're talking about Twilight Zone, one of the episodes, one of the lines from the Twilight Zone that I quote a lot is from Number 12, "Looks Just Like You," where the state was going to, at that time when you came of age, I guess the girl was turning 18, I think probably 18, but so at that point you made a decision to convert, and you get to choose one of like 12 models or whatever, and they're basically faces and bodies of, you know, supermodels. And so you choose whichever, you know, one you like the best. So everybody in society, all other than the young people, really young people, they all looked identical. It's like 12 models. And so she was fighting this, naturally. And she talked about her father and said, you know, my father, you know, once said, if everyone is beautiful, no one will be. And that's exactly right, isn't it? That because you have to have something to contrast it with. Beauty can't exist without ugliness. It's like yin and yang. And that's why for the woke friends out there, I talk about this all the time in terms of racism. You know, racism can't exist if there is no such thing as anything that's not racist. You have to contrast it with something. So it's the same thing. You have to have something to compare it to. And beauty means nothing. If everybody looks beautiful, then it's not beautiful anymore, is it? I guess, well, maybe you could look at the tigers and things like that. Yes, I did. Do you cover Brittany Murphy in your book? Not, yes, I did. I covered it in a pretty long section. A very, very strange death. And her husband as well. And, you know, why she married that guy, I don't understand. She married a really creepy guy. And he ended up dying a couple months after her in very much the same way. And he was about 10 years older than her. He was still only 40-ish. She was like 30, if that. Something like that. And, you know, for those who don't know, she was found dead under unclear circumstances. Her mother was involved kind of in both ways. There are rumors maybe the mother was sleeping with the husband. Simon Monjak is the name. First people thought maybe he was involved, like he killed her or something, because he was kind of suspicious. But then he dies himself a couple months later. The father, Brittany Murphy's father, who just died a couple years ago at like 80-some years old, I have many, many quotes from him in the book, because he tried very, very hard. He talked about and this is what you find in Hollywood, these deaths. Now, I don't know what it means. That's why I have a lot of affinity for Randy Quaid and his Star Wackers theory, because it does seem that way. We know that, you know, Brittany Murphy is not like, you know, one of the Kennedys, where they're being knocked off because of who they are and their association with people that were dangerous to the elite, to the corrupt elite at one point. I don't think Brittany Murphy was dangerous to anybody, but she was clearly, I think, murdered by someone or something, and they covered it up and made a nonsensical explanation. They did an inadequate investigation. You look into these deaths, and it's very much like the political ones. Either they don't do autopsies or they don't do certain things. I have lots of, deaths will occur, and I'll when I was writing on Barred Fame, I never found any updates. So the police is still, there's a voice actress, Christine Cavanaugh, who I like very much. She did the voice of Chucky Finster on the Rugrats. My kids used to love Rugrats, and he was my favorite Rugrat. I loved her voice. She also did Dexter from Dexter's Laboratory, another show that they loved when they were little, that I loved too. I loved her. She did the character of Babe in the movie Babe as well. Very prolific voice actress. She died at 50-ish, something like that. And the cause of her death was never released and has never been released. And it's been probably 10, 15 years. So I find that very strange. Now, I don't know, that I don't think she was a thorn in anyone's, side. But it's very strange, however you look. Really covered it. Loved her as the Lion and King of the... Yeah, that's right. Thanks. Yeah, but Bruce and Brandon Lee cursed her, Brian murdered. Yeah, and again, Bruce Lee, and of course you had the thing with Todd Baldwin. I mean, how many times? Again, if you're on a movie set, how do you possibly have lime and ammunition in those guns? How can that ever happen? So, of course, Bruce Lee's death, very strange. And I cover that in the book as well, where this guy was probably in maybe better physical condition than 99.99% of the, human beings will ever be. Peak physical condition. And to die of something, I can't remember. I think they tried to eventually say it was something with the sweat gland. It's just ridiculous reason at all. And of course, there's, rumors that the Chinese Asian warlords or Asian martial arts experts wanted to assassinate him because he was giving away their secrets. I don't know that he was doing research. And then, of course, his son, Brandon Lee, again, Kennedy-esque thing. He died with this live bullet in the round. I think there was somebody else. Was it John Hexum, I think, another actor? Same thing. And then you have the woman – cameraman or whatever it was that tragically died with Alec Baldwin. That's not acceptable that would ever happen, and for it to happen repeatedly. I think twice about being on a movie set. Yes, I did cover Bruce in my book, Chuck. I covered Brandon not as much, but Bruce I did. As I said, I think the official explanation that some guy wrote a book not that long ago where he tried to claim it was something to do with his sweat glands. It was completely ridiculous. Okay. Yes, Master of Psychology as well. Yes, he only started teaching special. And, in recent years, was it Tarantino that doesn't like Bruce Lee? They came in. Of course, I don't like Tarantino, so that doesn't surprise me. Tried to claim he wasn't really that good. I don't know. It's revisionist stuff. Let's see. Conspiracy theorists blamed Lee's death on the Chinese mafia. Yes, exactly. Yep. Even a family curse. Well, it sounds like the Kennedys, doesn't it? Vic Morrow, certainly. Vic Morrow. But, that would be the, you know, the helicopter accident on the Twilight Zone set, and the children that died, and, you know, John Landis. That I remember having a kind of that left a bad taste in my mouth towards him, because I think I could be wrong, but my impression was that he was kind of cavalier about those kids dying and Morrow dying. And I don't know. I just think a movie director should have been more upset than that. You know, if you're making a movie, you shouldn't be dying on it. Oh, Wise Wolf Radio, good to see you. The wisest wolf in town. Thanks, Tony. Love the show. That's great. Fantastic. But and I am on Fridays now. I am over on aftermath.fm. I'm doing iProtest there now. And hopefully you'll be able to do it this Friday. I haven't even got the guests lined up yet. Whether I can rant for 2 hours, I don't know. But it does have an active chat room that I signed up for over there. And we'll see if the phone lines work. But obviously phone calls are hit or miss at all these places. Sometimes I would get some. Sometimes not. So, yes, Jay, they do have a chat. And I'm going to be leaving. Look on Facebook. You have to go to Discord for it, but I'm going to leave the link there for all you guys. So I hope you and Chris and Peter and other people call. And the number is now is 3. If they call in here, which you can still do, 319-527-5016. That's 319-527-5016. Aftermath. Yes, aftermath.fm. Oh, cool. Thanks. Yeah, you come on again Friday. That'd be great. Yeah, because many people holding my hand through this, you know, and once I get the hang of it, it's cool. But I'm not the most, you know, even though I love independence, I don't have a real, I have kind of a dependent personality. You know, I tell my wife all the time, you know, I basically, you know, my mom took care of me when I was young, and, you know, she takes care of me, you know, now. I just kind of, I never was really great at being independent. I like having a woman taking care of me. John Landis and his wife held a party and invited the jurors after John was acquitted of manslaughter. I did not know that. Wow, very smuggly. Yeah, he is. Well, I've seen him. He's very. But you'd think after something like that, the smugness would go. But no, he's got a. You're right, an arrogance or whatever you would call about it. Well, thank you, Chuck. If you ever need a guest just slightly better than old shoe, I'll do it for you. Yeah, I'll. I appreciate the offer, Chuck. Yeah, I really haven't even tried. I need to, because I don't feel I want to make sure I know what's going on there as far as that. And I'm also going to try to do, I don't know if Chris and Jay and Peter, Tony, you guys, and I've been having people tell me again this week, I need to do a Facebook Live thing. People keep telling me I need to do that. So it's real easy to do, right? I just go on and do it. I think even I can figure them out. I think I'm going to do it Saturday if I can figure that out. We'll see what kind of, but of course I'll be distraught if I don't get much. If I have like five people watching or something, that's why a lot of times I don't do this, because I can't stand the rejection, you know. But of course, you know, the shadow ban I have on Facebook is just really something. They don't, they social media, they never have even warned me. And, you know, if you read me on social media, you know I'm very controversial. People a lot less controversial than me, and people that have a lot less audience than I do, have been banned. They're in Facebook jail. I've never even been warned once. But I started, you know, wondering why suddenly my posts, you know, I get almost no response. And what they do is they just limit who sees my posts. So I sometimes I can circumvent it. Like I'll have somebody post something for me, and I'll share that. And that'll get a lot of response. Usually, not always, though. Sometimes it doesn't work, but it's very strange. So it's there. I guess, you know, they decided to take a different tack with some people. Facebook Live is just one button on a smartphone. Okay. Well, we'll see if I can handle it, Chuck. I don't know. Chris has met him. He's met Landis. He's very interested. You've met a lot of guys, too. It's amazing. There's people that I talk to. You guys have so many great connections. I really haven't met very many of these people. Chris said, "You try. Yes, you did try to get me. Did you send me the story? You sent me so much stuff. Okay, yeah, I know. I just have people telling me that it seems really easy. And it seems kind of cool, especially if you do have people there. So I'm going to try it. Randy Quaid claims that Heath Ledger, Chris Penn, and David Carradine were killed by Star Riders. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, you know, people think Randy Quaid's crazy, and he certainly has that persona now. You know, he's got the right look for it. And, you know, keep in mind that the guy's a great actor. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, that's what I'm fascinated with when talking about show business. All the world's a stage on how much is this is, you know, how much is this theatrical? We don't know. But he, I think he's got a point here, because if you look at these, and, you know, a lot of the deaths, they don't make any sense. Brittany Murphy's a perfect example, you know, a nice, very cute, lovely young girl who was. I will say there is one connection to her. A woman, I think her name was Julia Davis, and I tried to track her down. That Brittany Murphy was connected to her, and she was a whistleblower that was talking about you know, dangerous people being led in the country or something. I wouldn't even really understand what she was blowing the whistle on, but supposedly Brittany Murphy was going to be a character witness for her or something. I don't know. So there's. That's something, I guess, maybe possibly, but for the most part, you know, you read about these people, and it's like, it doesn't look like there would be any real reason for them to be knocked off, although you don't know. Like, if I hadn't been at Mark Lane's office as a teenager back in late 1976, stuffing envelopes at Citizens Committee of Inquiry, I would not have known that Mark Lane had any interest at all. I mean, that Freddie Prinze had any interest at all in the JFK assassination. Freddie Prinze, for those of you who are too young out there, he was a really up-and-coming comedian. Freddie Prinze Jr., probably heard of his son, who became an actor, but he was one of the top stand-ups, started a show called Chico and the Man, was a big hit on TV, and he was 22 years old. They claimed he killed himself. He was into drugs and so forth, and you know, fast times, you know, Hollywood lifestyle, you know, people have been there and done that. They've heard it a million times. Sure, it's believable. But, and I would have believed it, but I knew he was there. I knew he was obsessed with the JFK assassination at the time of his death, according to Mark Lane, and also according to John Barber, who also interviewed him, told me. But there was not one word about the JFK assassination in the made-for-TV movie they made about Freddie Prinze's last days. That's when, as a teenager, it really started to hit home what kind of power our state-controlled media has, because when they can take something like that and, you know, they're just completely painting a dishonest portrait to try to make someone look like a derelict drug addict, which, I mean, he might have been. He probably was a drug addict. But they should have incorporated his obsession in the JFK assassination. The final days of Freddie Prinze revolved around the JFK assassination in real life, and they never mentioned it. And that was huge to me when I saw that. I said, wow, this is really bigger than I ever thought. Okay, Tony said that you can help me with the Facebook Live non check us right. This one, cool. All right, well, I hope that I'll be able to figure it out. And Tony, you helped me with so much stuff. And I got your message. I'll get back to you on that. I appreciate that. That's fine. Although I don't know why are you sending me a check. I don't even know. Is that for the sponsors? But I really appreciate everything you do. You and Chris and Peter. There's just so much. And Chuck, I mean, you guys have been so supportive and helpful. Maria Heller got so banned she had to start using her maiden name on Facebook. Yeah, Maria Romino, my new friend Maria Romino. I said, who's this hot Maria Romino that looks like Sophia Loren? It was comical. I mean, she was banned all the time, and I don't know that she's posting as controversial stuff as I do. I don't understand it. I really don't. Suicide by its nature spawns conspiracy theories among anyone who survives. Nobody kills themselves, and it's inevitable. Yeah, well, you know, and was it God, who was it? You know, and I'm sorry I'm blanking out on who told me, but it made me start thinking, you know, that, you know, police have long had a tendency to try to conclude suicide. And just, you know, I point that in On Borrowed Fame over and over again. You have police say they don't suspect foul play. There was no evidence of foul play. They say that right away, real instinctively. And someone, and I'm sorry, I can't think of who it is now. I'm sorry. If you're listening, forgive me that I'm not remembering it. But they just said, you know, this is because they want to keep maybe it's Bob Wilson. It's Bob Wilson. They want to keep the murder rates down. So that they want to make it look like, they don't want to make it look like, you know, murders are happening in their area. So it's much easier to driven the suicide of my own Fairfax County, Virginia, Tommy Burkett, was a very tragic story. Young college student who was, and his story was on Unsolved Mysteries. Used to be great back in the day. A lot of, you know, that's where I learned about the Boys on the Tracks, you know, with my deceased friend now, Linda Eyes, and her deceased daughter, Lisa. And I'm going to be having a show about that soon. I have a couple people that want to be on a show about the Boys on the Tracks because, you know, Linda died, the mother died after fighting forever, and then her daughter died very mysteriously at way too young an age, a couple of months after that, still trying to. And I communicated with both of them, and a lot involved there. Those are probably two of the most prominent, entries in the Clinton body count. Tommy Burkett was, his story was on Unsolved Mysteries as well. And, you know, on the surface, okay, looks like small change. He was a college kid who was apparently working undercover as some kind of a DE agent on campus for the police, and he was found dead in his home. Clearly he had been murdered. The evidence of murder was everywhere. You had neighbors that saw suspicious cars and comings and goings. The evidence was overwhelming that he had been murdered. The police just swept it under the rug and said he killed himself. Of course, his parents were incensed. Both his parents died within, I mean, I communicated with his, I think both of them. The mother died way too young of a broken heart, and then the father died. So there's nobody left. And that case haunts me because the family's gone, and they clearly, for whatever reason, now is Bob Wilson right? Do they do that just because they don't want, they want a lower number of murders in there? Maybe so. I never thought, that never occurred to me. So it's possible. So maybe that's happening in Hollywood sometimes too. It's easier, and isn't it easier also just to say you don't have to investigate much if you say they killed themselves? You don't have to find, you know who did it, right? And but of course, family, and I understand that family members are going to balk most of the time at any suggestion that their loved one, because I mean that's obviously the biggest hurt in the world. Your loved one, you know, cared so little about their lives and how it would impact you that they took their own lives. That's got to be the most awful feeling in the world. So it's understandable why people would, you know, protest that and say, no, that's not true. But I think a lot of times, right, that the evidence shows a murder. And for whatever reason, whether it's just simply to get the numbers down, or if there's a deeper, darker reason, which I suspect there is a lot of times, because, yeah, of course, that, you know, kind of plays into my feelings about police itself. You, those of you who have read my, or know that I don't have a high opinion of law enforcement, especially our policing for profit system in general. Mary Kate Olson wants immunity from prosecution. Yes, Fortune Incorporated by Heath Ledger. Yep. Yep, Mary Kate Olson, the Olson twins. Actor Jim Caviezel stepped up his embrace of QAnon. Wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know he, I know he's really into, he's a big time Catholic, and he's right there with Mel Gibson, but I'm sure he's not there. I had no more. He's getting less and less likely to be hired for movie roles. I love the guy as an actor, but I admire him being going against the grain. I don't know. How is anybody still believing in QAnon? As I understand it, it was ridiculous enough that JFK Jr. was coming back, but now they're upping it by, they claimed to announce that JFK himself was going to come back at 104 years old. I mean, after being having his head shot off, I mean, just absolutely ridiculous. Of course, we'd all love to think that, wouldn't that be cool? But I mean, come on, really. Personally, looking into my father's suicide, knowing more than half dozen others who did, it gives me a certain sense. Yeah, I didn't know that, Jack, and I'm sorry to hear that. But Steve Cameron has been on the show, and his father died under very murky circumstances. I get he have a show sometime, and he's tried to look into that, but I know he's dissent, and I need to maybe do a show on that, incorporate some of these other deaths into that. But there's a lot of corruption that happens, and I have some friends I'm trying to get her story clear, Carolyn out there, to try to get it to go from point A to point Z, because it's a huge story. There's a lot involved, but it involves municipal corruption, and it's not just police, but local officials. There's so much, you know, kind of walking tall movie type of corruption out there that isn't talked about. And it affects people's lives. It certainly impacted hers. It ruined her life. And it ruins lots of people's lives at that level. They're just, it just doesn't get talked about as much as if you were a Hollywood movie star or if you were a politician. Passion of the Christ guy. I'd like to see Rich. Yeah, exactly. That's right. He played Christ. Yeah. Would have been billed to QAnon believers historically. The actor best known for playing Jesus. Oh, okay. Reenacted a speech from Braveheart. I didn't know that. He was there then. There was the audience to send Lucifer and his henchmen straight back. Really? Is that real? That's incredible. Wow. That's a lack of motivation to dedicate time and resources to anyone's domestic. Yeah, exactly. And, I'm going to have a whole section in Hidden History 3 on asset forfeiture laws. It's the heart of policing for profit. Now, this is something that involves Ronald Reagan. It involves Joe Biden. Joe Biden bragged about, loving these assets. Clinton certainly steeped them up in the 90s, but it happened in the 80s. That's when they first instituted them. And this is the idea that the government, and just keep in mind, let's say you're and this has happened to many, many parents, too many, or children do drugs. Say their child, teenage child, or maybe young adult child still living at home, is selling small amounts of marijuana out of the house. Well, because he's selling out of their house, the house becomes a crime scene under asset forfeiture. The state can seize their house, and they have done it repeatedly. I got a caller. Okay. We'll go back to that. Caller, okay. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me pretty good?
Yes, I can.
Oh, this is Jimmy James. Just wanted to get your opinion on the whole Rittenhouse thing. I have a feeling that almost the entire media has purposely set up the whole thing to a tinderbox where they're going to cause a bunch of race riots.
Well, I think that, that's a I look at it, it's almost like an OJ case where I don't really see the interest in it. I don't know why it's getting it reminds me of the Kavanaugh case too. I didn't understand that at all. I think it was kind of a time waster. It really has no significance beyond this kid's wife. There are people that believe that he's part of the PSYOP and it's not real, which I can easily go along with that. But what I don't like is, to the extent that this is real, I don't like the fact that there is a feeling in the air. It's almost like, in the old days when they used to try mobsters, no one wanted to serve on the jury because you didn't want to risk, having your house burned down or having your family hurt or being killed or voting against So this is what we're in, this kind of, intimidation. And this is what I'm talking about. The government, there should not be, as I understand, there's graffiti outside the courthouse, there are demonstrations. That should be allowed. Those are one demonstrations you need to break, or move them at least away from the courthouse, because that has an intimidating effect on the jury. And I don't, we already have such a screwed up legal system as it is. When you get to the point where you can, you have jurors scared to vote a particular way, then something is really, really, really wrong. And exactly, and it's. I have a comment on Skype here. Race riots start over white pilling people killing white people. Yeah, I don't even understand the dynamic here, because there's everybody involved is the same race. So I don't understand how this becomes a racial issue, but it has. And I don't like for the right to make Rittenhouse a hero. Well,
You know what this has made me figure out, though, Don, is I was always under the false impression that the left was running the media. Right. Now I get it. No, it's the opposite. The media is running the left. There's going to be a whole half of the country that when they learn these verdicts, they're going to be shocked and amazed because they know absolutely none of the facts of the case.
Yeah. Well, it's just, you know, Tucker Carlson has done a really good job on covering it. Again, I think it's, you know, I think we're paying way too much attention to it. But to the extent that it's real and it's not just theater, you're hearing crossing state lines. I mean, apparently he lived right on the border there between the states. So it was only a total of like
21 miles away.
Yeah, 21 miles
away. 20 miles away. The boy's father lived in the town.
Yeah.
And they're saying, oh, he had no business there. What about the two guys that were supposed to be in jail that he shot? Because both of them had warrants out and were career criminals. They're the ones that shouldn't have been on the street.
Exactly. And this is all, and it becomes like, what happens is, and that's why being a civil libertarian is so hard these days. Because everyone's, in, you know, like, if being a civil libertarian means you fight harder for people that you personally are repelled by. Let's say, I don't know, say some John McAdams was still alive, somebody that, was perpetuating a myth constantly, pushing that Oswald did it. And I know that has to have an agenda because you can't know anything about this case and believe that. But if he was on trial, I wouldn't, unless it were, the evidence was overwhelming, he did something bad. Or, you know, I'm just using him as an example, but somebody like that, Bugliosi when he was alive, and these people, I still would want them to get, if Hillary Clinton was on trial, I would want her to be given the presumption of innocence. I wouldn't want her or anybody else railroaded. I don't understand that, but the woke left wants they don't like, look, Roger Stone's a perfect example. So many people hated him. So they didn't mind that this judge in this case, I was actually shocked because it's really kind of an activist, I guess, conservative judge, but you don't see that much. And so the bias is very obvious. You see that kind of bias on the other side, sort of like Amy Berman Jackson, who is incredibly biased against Roger Stone. But we can't have – theoretically, you should not know. I mean, that guy, judge shouldn't have had his ringtone or anything like that. You should know what – the judge's politics are. The idea is they're supposed to be above politics. We know they're not, but theoretically, every judge should be a civil libertarian. They should be there. And I did like the fact he brought up the Fifth Amendment because that was incredible. That, you know, they, if you remember back in the commie witch hunting days, all of those guys used the Fifth Amendment. I plead the Fifth. I reserve the right not to incriminate myself. That's what the Fifth Amendment is. And the left back then revered that you have that right. That's all was happening here. Basically, the prosecution was questioning this kid. Why did you stay silent when you're arrested? I mean, this goes to Miranda rights and everything else. I mean, this is how crazy the left is now, because they just want people that they're repelled by, that they can associate with Trump because they see that giant orange face everywhere, and that's what they wanted. So it's fair. But like I said, I think it's basically a huge distraction, and I don't see any good that can come out of this, because if he's found not guilty or sufficiently not guilty, like if he's just convicted on a minor charge, the left is going to go crazy because they will not accept any, and I don't think the right will go crazy if it's the other way. They don't do that. And you can't have that kind of a system, you know, where you're going to riot if you don't get the result you want.
Right. It's getting to the point where we're being... how should I put it? The tyranny of the supposed majority.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's absolute tyranny, and it's not the left that I mean, this is, if you want to, know where the left is right now, you friends that I've had on the show, Naomi Wolf, Cindy Sheehan, Cynthia McKinney. There's lots of good. Tulsi Gabbard, who I'd love to have on the show. There's lots of good people on the left. Bobby Kennedy Jr., watch that interview with him. That's a classical liberal. That's what I am. He's talking about the Bill of Rights. He's concerned about that. He's concerned about the tyrannical forces. And he said, back then in 1776, you can't, why are we so scared of this virus? And those people, our founders, were less concerned about dying than they were about having these, preserving these rights for the people. And, you know, we have to get back to that. We can't, you can't, you know, it's very distressing to watch it, but there's no good that's going to come because they, and again, the media is so complicit in this because, you know, they stoke to whatever extent there are, but there are always activists involved. If riots happen, they happen because the activists start them. The undercover agents always, they always get tripped. People are too apathetic. They're not going to go out and march on themselves. They won't. The activists and the media triggers it. Expected riots are expected. Will they riot? They do this all the time. They are absolutely despicable.
Sure, they build it up. And where do these pallets of bricks magically show up?
Right, exactly. Where were they? Where do they? That's something that should have been asked, but not going to be asked outside a conspiracy world. But anyhow, so that's. But I. So what? What? Anything else on your mind?
Oh, I guess that's a great interview with McBride. I wish I could have heard more on Tippett. Maybe you can give him back someday.
Yeah, yeah. We'll try to, because there's so much stuff to talk about. And he wanted to talk about his book on Billy Wilder. That went up to do it. But I appreciate it, Jim. It's always great to hear from you. Thanks for calling.
Yep. Have a good one. Bye.
You too. Thank you. Who killed Superman? George Reeves. Absolutely. There's well, I don't think he killed himself. And again, there's an example of Hollywood sweeping that. And if you watch Hollywoodland, which was a pretty good movie, and Ben Affleck, you know, for those of you that don't think he can act, he looked like George, and he did a really good passable impersonation of George Reeves. Did a good job in that movie. The problem is they set the premise out and then they kind of they leave it hanging, where all the evidence shows that George Reeves didn't kill himself. I mean, he had – and you talk about a mob-influenced figure, Eddie Mannix, who I write a lot about in On Borrowed Fame. He was a mobster behind the scenes that was – he was basically Leo G. Mayer's at MGM, basically his personal bodyguard almost. This is a fixer par excellence. So Clark Gable, you know, rumors Clark Gable killed somebody in a drunk driving accident. He went and fixed it. One of the stars got, you know, Clark Gable and others knocked up some girls. You know, he went and fixed, paid for the abortions, you know, whatever. This is what Eddie Mannix did. He was much like Morris Levy and the mob type executives you saw in the record businesses that terrorized, especially the black artist, and didn't want to pay royalties to anyone and just, you know, ruled with an iron fist. Mannix is that guy. He was a tough guy. And you didn't cross him. And MGM had a lot of power back then. But George Reeves was playing with fire. George Reeves was having an affair with Tony Mannix, Eddie Mannix's wife. So, you know, you're doing something like that, I knew who my chief suspect would be. And so the movie kind of alludes to that, but it ultimately kind of wimps out, in my opinion. And I wish they had come down more firmly, but, you know, Hollywood is Hollywood. You know, they don't all do like Oliver Stone did in JFK. You come down firmly on the side of truth, but most of the time they kind of straddle the line, and that's what Hollywood done did. But unfortunate. I remember watching Superman reruns when I was a little kid, and he was already dead. I didn't realize that when I was little, but I remember first learning that he had died a while back. You know, we were distraught. Superman died, whatever. But lots and lots of cases like that are examined in the book. So hope people will check it out. I did a lot of work on the Marilyn Monroe case, obviously, indebted to my friend David Wayne, among others, for that. And what do I have here? Oh, okay. But then we have John Belushi's sleeping with a mobster's wife and girlfriend. That'd go ahead for the mobster's informants. Hey, absolutely, it certainly is, and that's, and you know, that's, it's very, it was very similar to the death of Thelma Todd, who the ice cream blonde, they called her. Watch Laurel and Hardy. in some of the early shorts. Thelma Todd was just delightful, just, you know, gorgeous blonde who was really good comedian, you know, very funny and just charming on screen. And she was only like early 20s and, you know, found dead, very mysterious circumstances, in her car. They claimed she killed herself even though she had bruises and, you know, was eaten and everything. And she had been messing with a couple different mobs. And one of them, what was the guy's name? But there was a, and of course there's Ted Healy, the same kind of way, the guy that was the original. If you watch the Three Stooges, before the Three Stooges became Moe, Larry, and Curly, they worked with a guy named Ted Healy, and you can see him in some early talkies. He was the guy that did the slapping, not Moe. But Ted Healy died a very strange death, and the rumor was that Wallace Beery, who was a big actor then, MGM, Wallace Beery, along with a couple mob-affiliated, including Albert Broccoli later became a producer of the James Bond films. But these were all mob people. And the rumor is they took, I don't know why they did it, he just owed money to somebody, but they took him out in an alley and beat him to death. And they covered it up. They sent Wallace Beery on a vacation to Europe. And but that's the kind of stuff that used to happen in Hollywood. And you had somebody like Eddie Mannix was in the heart of it. And when Eddie Mannix died, you know, one of his Paul Burns was James Stewart, who really was a choir boy in comparison. I mean, James Stewart came to Hollywood and he was reading Flash Gordon comics. He was that aw shucks guy you saw on TV. And, rumor was Leo G. Mayer was trying to get him set up with hookers because they said the guy, you know, he wasn't really being seen with any women. And he just was, wasn't interesting. He was, but he later became kind of a ladies' man. Even Beaver's TB mom was married. I did not know that. I did not know Barbara Billingsley was mobbed up. I do know, like I said, Donna Reed was apparently screwing around with Johnny Roselli, which crushes me. But, it is what it is in Hollywood. I mean, Bugsy Siegel was a real ladies' man. And, you know, it's just, you know, when you see these gorgeous girls and you know that they're, consorting with, you know, sometimes hit, you know, it's hard to stomach, but you know, it is what it is. But Jimmy Stewart was one of those guys that you find no scandal about him anywhere. And it's nice to know because he's my favorite actor. So we're winding down, but I want to just promote again the book Unbarred Fame, Money, Mysteries, and Corruption in the Entertainment World. It's out there in all the usual places. Now the Kindle version is out there. Paperback goes officially on sale early December. But you can pre-order it, have an audio version down the line. So, and McBride's book is the book on Billy Wilder. God, I forget. Let me open his email to get the exact same. Sorry about that. Why doesn't he have it in here? He does not have it listed here. Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, just released in October, Columbia University Press. So check out that as well. Check out my book. Catch me on America Unplugged Radio every Saturday at noon as well with the great Tony Arterburn and Billy Ray Valentine. Thanks so much for listening to us. Keep sending forth those tiny ripples of hope.